Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, Al.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding and we talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. On today's show, we have a Mike Mentzer tribute. We're going to bring back John Little, who was one of my favorite guests from last year. John is an author and a writer and also a filmmaker. And John was a personal friend of Mike Mentzer, and he wrote quite a few books about Mike Mentzer. He also wrote many articles about Mike when he was alive. And last week, June 10th in 2001, was the anniversary of Mike Mentzer's death. Mike has been gone now for 20 years, and I thought it would be a good opportunity to bring John Little back on the show and talk a little bit about Mike Mentzer. And John was totally agreeable with that, and he wanted to come on. And coincidentally, because of COVID last year, John lives in Canada, and he was kind of stuck in the house, and he could not go anywhere because Canada has some really strict rules regarding COVID. So John put together a little bit of a documentary, like kind of like an audio book of Mike Mentzer's last interview. So it was an interview he did with John and also an interview he did with Peter McGough, which I believe was about, I don't know how long before Mike died. But it was really great because you got to hear in Mike's own words, him kind of narrating his own life. So that's what we're going to talk about in our interview today with John Little. It's actually going to be part one of two parts because we talked for so long. And in this part, we're going to talk about Mike's history in bodybuilding, how he got started in bodybuilding and all the different contests he went in. And we're going to cover all those in detail. So it's a really, really great interview. And I'm glad John was able to come back on the show because he's really a great guest. And I think you guys are really going to enjoy this episode, this interview. And then right after we get done with that, I'm going to read an article from the January 1977 issue, which will tie in with our interview. And it's about the 1976 American Bodybuilding Championships, which was the first major contest that Mike Mentzer won. And that was held in New York, where Mike beat Danny Padilla and Roger Callard. And he really came on the bodybuilding scene. So that was written by Jack Neary, another great guest that we had on recently on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, and you guys are going to enjoy that as well. Before we get to that, I want to mention our sponsor, who is Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services that ensure you will not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing that they're there for you every step of the way. Their competitive pricing, along with their quality products and services, are just a few reasons to give them a call. So call them at their office number in Tampa, Florida, 813-922-8939, or you can just go to their website, which is flalternativemeds.com. Again, that's flalternativemeds.com. AlternativeMeds.com. They have offices all over the United States, but they can work with anybody in the continental United States just through their website. Tell them that you heard their ad on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, and they'll give you a free consultation. Plus, they'll give you 20% off your first order. All right. So before we get to our interview with John Little, I do want to mention some big news. The audiobook that I was talking about my book, Bodybuilding Heroes and Legends Volume 1, is now available. So if you go to our website, which is called bodybuildinglegendshow.com, you'll see it right there on the front page. You can purchase the audiobook of my book, Bodybuilding Heroes and Legends Volume 1. I narrate the whole book. I believe it's 13 chapters, including the introduction, and only $16. So if you haven't purchased the book itself, if you don't have time to read books, as most of us don't nowadays, including myself, and you like hearing audiobooks, you can listen to it on your phone or in your car or wherever you like listening to your podcasts or audiobooks. You can just listen to it on your personal device and just download it and listen to it as much as you want. So check that out if you're interested. Just go, like I said, to bodybuildinglegendshow.com and you'll see it right there on the front page. And you can do a quick and easy purchase and check it out. See what you think. All right. And we do have some emails, so I want to read those emails before we get to our interview. Nothing about last week's interview that we did with Annabelle Lopez and Bill Nealon about the visit they did with Chris Dickerson. I didn't get any about that. But I did get a few more emails here, so I want to read those. If you guys are interested in emailing me about the show, I love to hear your emails. I love to hear your feedback. So you can do that at naturalolympia@gmail.com. All right, this first email is from Christopher Flory. He says, greetings, Mr. Hansen. I love all your interviews. Great info. You really know your history, too. Quick question, if you don't mind. I think it may have been on one of your Palumbo interviews discussing Arthur Jones. I believe you mentioned the two influences on Jones. One was Earl Lederman. Unfortunately, I could not catch what the other person or influence on him was, and having trouble finding that specific interview. Any info on this would be really helpful as I'm researching the lineage of various bodybuilding styles and methods. Thanks again for all the great super interviews. Best to you, Christopher from Long Island, New York. Yeah, I think you might be mistaking my interview with someone else, Christopher, because I didn't do an interview with Palumbo about Arthur Jones. We did talk, I think, about Mike Mentzer, but nothing about Arthur Jones. So that might have been another interview that Dave Palumbo did. And when I told Christopher that, he wrote me back and he said, thanks for speedily responding and the interview info. I appreciate it. I also appreciate the recent interview you did with Palumbo on natural bodybuilding. I'll keep searching. Interesting you should mention Jones' son, because I'm currently reading William Jones's in-depth book, The Lost Empire of Arthur Jones. I will have to check out that Dave Palumbo interview with his son. Arthur Jones was definitely a Bronze Age style, red-pilled, somewhat eccentric alpha male, the kind we need more of today. Stay healthy, stay strong, Christopher. This was from our friend Andrew Heffernan, who is one of our Patreon sponsors. Andrew says, hey, John, thanks so much for reading the great Neary article about the show no one will stop talking about, the 1980 Mr. O. I'd never read that account, only Charles Gaines' version and the updated Pumping Iron, which was clearly a pro-Arnold rundown. Neary's more objective retelling makes it clear that the contest was indeed a fiasco and that Arnold didn't serve the title. I loved hearing his version of the backstage goings-on and the near fistfight between Arnold and Mentzer, a tense moment that we've heard about from numerous angles on your show. Thanks for sharing, and all the best to the great Chris Dickerson. I hope he gets better, and I'd love for him to come on your show one more time. All the best, Andrew Heffernan. All right, thank you, Andrew. And speaking of that backstage run-in with Arnold and Mentzer, we talk about that in detail on this interview with John Little coming up, because Mike Mentzer really gives some detail about that I had not heard before. So you guys want to stay tuned for that. That's going to be really interesting. And then I got another email from Dennis B. Weiss. I don't know if you guys remember Dennis Weiss, but he was a big bodybuilding writer, and he wrote several books, I believe, for Bob Kennedy. And Dennis wrote, and he said, I thoroughly enjoy the Bodybuilding Legends podcast each week. I think Pat Neve would be a great guest on your show. And I wrote Dennis back, and I told him we did interview Pat probably about 2 or 3 years ago. So if you guys are looking for any of our old interviews, we've done a ton already because we've done so many shows. We've been going on for like almost 4 years now. You can go to my website, bodybuildinglegendshow.com, and just click on the podcast link on the top. And you'll see all the interviews we've done since we started on January 5th, 2017. So we got our 4-year anniversary coming up. All right. On our Apple Podcast reviews, if you listen to our show on Apple Podcast, if you have an iPhone and you listen to your podcast on your iPhone, you can leave a review there and give us 5 stars. And we did get a couple new ones. This one was from Jody, who was from the United States Air Force, and it was from January 6th. It says, authentic bodybuilding history, the real deal. I would highly recommend this podcast to any fan of bodybuilding. John is a natural bodybuilding champion who has dedicated his life to the sport and is an expert at bringing the past alive through his guests and his knowledge. The sport can at times suffer a bad reputation. Through his guests, John cuts through the fluff, which typical bodybuilding magazines traditionally display, and he does so often with a no-holds-barred attitude. His legendary guests are top-notch. Thank you, Jody. And this one is from, what's the word name here? Nene. And this was on January 12th. It says, the best podcast in history. The best podcast ever. Even if you're not into bodybuilding, I think you'll be interested in the golden era. Too much knowledge to waste and too many stories not to tell. Never one episode that failed to captivate me. Wonderful. Wow. Thank you very much. So like I said, if you guys listen to our show on Apple Podcasts, please leave a review there. And then I put our interview with Jerry Branum, Tom Terwilliger, and Phil Williams. I finally got part two done. So that is on my YouTube page, which is under my name, John Hansen. And I got quite a few comments on that. Angel Oliva said, guys, how can you forget the guy who had the best abs in the golden era, Pierre Vandenstein, besides Serge Nubre? Even Arnold once said in 74 that he had the best abs ever. Muhammad McAlay was no match for him in Verona at the 74 Universe. Angel, I got to admit, you're right. I totally messed up about that. Pierre Vandenstein from the early 70s had incredible abs. So, yeah, you're right on that one. He definitely should have been in the discussion, at least. Kevin said, John, I really enjoyed this video format. The conversation style with the photo overlays was captivating. Please have them on again. Greco said, I got to include Tony Pearson for the lat spread. We did do that. Angel Oliva again said, as far as the back, the very first guy I remember that had a Christmas tree lower back plus incredible traps from behind was none other than Paul Grant from Wales. Yeah, you're right. I think he did have Christmas tree lower back. Kermit Hitler said, I can't believe they didn't mention Bertel Fox for the most muscular pose. Yeah, we messed up with Bertel Fox. We should have included him with the side chest, the side tricep, and definitely the most muscular. Batman said, I wish Jeff King would have been in the IFBB. He was so good. David said, there should still be body part awards. Yeah, I agree with that. I wish they still had that too. That'd be cool. James Spriggs said, outstanding podcast, John. Thank you for taking the time and putting the pictures in. Please, could you do one for the 90s too with the same panel? Andrew Reinhardt said, these interviews are a great way to spend an hour or so watching. It reminds me of the talk shows on TV way back when. Just a few guys talking about the old days. RM said, amazing work. Thank you, John Hansen. I followed you for years, mate. Paul Hupp said, overhead abs. I thought Samir was number one, and then Phil Williams nailed it 10 seconds later. This one says, I was waiting for this. Thanks, John. Guy Graham said, best part of the show is all you guys laughing during the show. Yeah, we did have a good time. Chestnut said, Thierry Pastel looked great. Miles said, hey, guys, great video. So much more interesting than today's yawn fest of bodybuilding. Just one thing, Bertel Fox and the crab. Yep, I agree. Guy Graham said again, great series, John. Good comparisons, and the comments from Phil, Jerry, and Tom make the show. More of this format and other comparisons. Spirit said, Eduardo Koek had the most awesome abs I've ever seen, period. Frank the Tank said, McAway's core muscles have always been an inspiration for my core muscles in oblique workouts, and so for the past 35 years. Phil Williams for his magnificent back, deep and complete back, thick and wide. Great bodybuilding personalities in that podcast, including you, of course, John. Shannon Monroe said, more of these, please. Really fantastic. Great content, great champions. Dean Phillips said, damn, great video. Awesome. Tricky Fingers said, Robbie Robinson's rear double by was unbeatable. Remember that shot of him with the skull cap? Yeah, Robbie could have been in that too, for sure. Phillips said, fantastic. Lynn Roberts said, awesome again. Reinhardt said, never offer advice unless they ask for it. The Spritz said, Lance Spread, Lance Dreyer. Awesome. Popa said, John, you should do this Best Poses podcast for the 90s and 2000s. Also, it would be one cool way to see the pics. Stewart said, please interview Tim Belknap and Lance Dreyer. I did interview Lance probably 3 years ago. So, like I said, check out my Bodybuilding Legend Show website and look under podcasts and you'll see that interview with Lance. Kevin said, Arnold owns the crab most muscular. Les said, most muscular goes to Bertel Fox. Hendrick said, Bertel Fox had the freakiest most muscular of the 80s. Trapp said, best abs in general, Bronston Austin. Oh yeah, he was another good one. Crazy bicep peaks too, and more ripped up than most guys of his era and today. Rob said, the kangaroo wins. This guy said, the kangaroo was killed this week, hit by a car. Oh, really? Wow. The Spritz said, rear double bicep, Albert Beckles. I never saw anything even close. Yeah, you're right. We could have included Albert. He did have a freaky rear double bicep. So really ripped and muscular. Trapp said, overhead abs goes to Nubre and Pastel. The rear double biceps, Aaron Baker. Aaron Baker is 90s. Bertel Fox and Henry. David Henry, yeah, he's 90s, 2000s. front lat spread and back lat spread, Orville Burke. He's 90s. Joel Stubbs, he's 2000s. Front double bicep, Pastel, Robbie, Beckles, and the best, Jorma Ratti. There's so many more, but they stand out. Side chest, Arnold, Johnny Jackson, yeah, he's 2000. Marvin Etter, 4-inch thick pecs, no drugs back then. Most muscular, Arnold, Louis, Dexter's 980s. Bertel, there's more, but they stand out. Andy said Pierre Vandenstein for abs. Steve said, I enjoy the 80s stories with the serious bodybuilders. Please stay away from them freaks like Big Lenny. Stewart said Danny Padilla. Trapp said Jorma Ratti, front double biceps. And old school bodybuilding routine said Arnold. All right, so that's the comments we got on my YouTube page. And also on my YouTube page this week, I put up a posing routine of Robbie Robinson from the 1988 U.S. Pro Bodybuilding Championships, which was held in Anaheim, California. And it was held right before the Pro World, which later became the Arnold Classic. Mike Christian won both those contests, and Brian Buchanan was second. Robbie was third, but he looked fantastic, and a lot of people thought Robbie should have won. And like I said, I've also got that Bodybuilding Legends podcast with me and Jerry and Tom and Phil. And this is part two of the interview where we talked about the overhead abs pose, the rear double bicep, rear lat spread, and the most muscular. So check out my YouTube page. And please subscribe to that. All right, guys, I think that's all I got. So here's our interview, part one of our interview with John Little, where we talk about the contest career of Mike Mensur. Here we go.
All right, welcome back to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. And my special guest this week is Mr. John Little. And John was our guest about a year ago, and it was one of our most popular interviews. And we had him on to talk about Mike Mensur, who John knew as a close friend. And since we're just going over the anniversary death of Mike, who died on June 10th, 2001, I thought we would bring John back and talk again more about Mike Mensur. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks, John. Always great to speak to you.
Same here.
Yeah. And I've got to say, too, right off the top, that one of the things I really like about your podcast as a viewer is the caliber of guests, like the bodybuilders that you have. Like you recently had Danny Padilla.
And yeah, that was great.
You've had Chris Dickerson and Boyer Coe and down the list. And each one of them sort of bring, for me, a different piece of the puzzle of Mike to them.
Yeah.
So when all those pieces get pressed into place, you get a much more comprehensive view of more elements and facets of his character and his existence, the things he did. So I thank you for that as a friend of Mike's. It's been an education for me as well.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you. Yeah, it's great hearing all these people talk about, you know, different competitions or different parts of their career. And, you know, everybody remembers things differently. So it's great hearing their perspective, you know.
Definitely. Yeah. And even just some of the anecdotes of palling around, like Jack Neary, when you had him.
Yeah, he was great. I loved talking to him.
He has a wealth of information.
Yeah, and he's such a great storyteller, too.
Yeah, and in my opinion, the best writer in bodybuilding, bar none. And and I would include Rick Wayne in that. And I think Rick Wayne was and is an exceptional writer.
Yeah.
But there was just elements of Jack's writing that it was effortless, the way he did it. And yet he painted word pictures that perfectly
captured
things that took place.
Yeah, it was so great for me to talk to him because right when I got into bodybuilding, that's when he started writing right around the same time for Muscle Builder. So when I started, I was reading all his articles and stuff.
And funny. Like, he had funny stuff. If you ever read his article called The Thinking Man's Bodybuilder on Mike Mensur, hilarious. It's about them palling around and buying booze together. And it was I think Mike enjoyed it, too, because he put it in his very first heavy duty book, which of course, which came out in 78 or something, or 77.
Yeah.
So Jack contributed that profile piece on Mike for the course, which was pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah. He had some great stories about Arnold, too. Like when they went to that party in New York.
Again? Yeah. That was nuts.
That was crazy. That's like the best night of your life, you know?
Yeah. Well, especially given sort of the heights that Arnold has ascended to think you're out driving around with him, he pulls over, pulls out a gun, fires it off in the air.
Yeah, that was so crazy. I loved it. It was awesome.
Yeah. Oh, there's very funny stories. And that's why you people need to tune into John's podcast.
That's right. All right. That's more than the 10 people out there that listen to it regularly.
Well, 11, including me. But that's
yeah, all right. Okay. Well, John, when I mentioned having you come on the show, you talked about during your time in COVID, because we were just talking, you're kind of stuck out there in Canada.
The yes, sir.
Are so bad, you guys can't really go out much or do anything.
No, can't.
So you kind of put together some audio tapes you had of Mike talking about his life, and you were kind enough to let me listen to them too. I was able to get a good sense of Mike's history through his own words, which was really, really fascinating.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. Many years ago, I did a film for Warner Brothers on Bruce Lee.
Yeah.
It was actually the first film I ever did. It was called Bruce Lee in His Own Words. And my motive for that was that at the time, which was the late 90s, there were so many people in the martial arts world that were claiming Bruce Lee said this, Bruce Lee said that, and speaking for him. And nobody had a means of going to the source at that
time.
And I happen to have discovered basically the only, what turned out to be his last surviving or only surviving video interview.
Wow, really?
So with that as an anchor and other audio material I was able to collect, and B-roll footage that Warner Brothers provided, I was able to put together a film in which, it wasn't a very long film, it was about 18 minutes, in which Bruce Lee told his own story in his own words. And his widow, Linda, had told me after she saw it, she said, you know, it was like he was in the room with me.
Wow.
And that, to me, was a home run, because that's my audience, that one person. If she believed it was authentic, that's all that mattered.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so that hooked me on the concept of in their own words, because if you've ever brushed shoulders with a celebrity of some stripe, the first thing your friends ask you when you get back is, hey, what's he like? What's this guy? What's he really like? And the cool thing about putting together a film like that is you can find out for yourself what it was like to spend a half hour or so with this person.
Yeah.
So, I always wanted to do that with Mike Mentzer because he was so multifaceted and interesting. But unfortunately, the available video footage is almost non-existent. I think Wayne Galosh has some videos that he shot on 8mm and Super 8.
Way back in the day.
Yeah, which, they're great. They're, at least they're records.
Yeah, absolutely.
I remember the Mr. Universe contest that Mike won with a perfect score being broadcast on television. But nobody knows where the master tape is now.
Yeah, I've never seen that either. I've seen pictures of like him on the rocks and the CBS television crews there with the camera, but I've never seen it.
Never seen the footage, yeah.
Right.
And I remember watching it on TV, and I had a VCR at the time. I didn't know Mike at the time either. I was just a fan.
Yeah.
And I was sitting on the couch, and I was watching it, and I thought, man, I really want to waste the energy to go up and push the cord. Cool that I am, and then the same thing with the 79 Olympia. They broadcast that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I didn't record it.
Yeah.
But my hope was always that someone wasn't as stupid as I was and that there's a cassette, a VHS somewhere in reasonable quality.
Yeah.
But anyway, what I ended up doing was cutting the audio together so that there is a narrative of Mike's life. And I really just did it for myself. So I have a record of Mike, and I drew it from interviews that I had done with Mike over a period of 5 or 6 years. No, geez, it would be back to 81. So it would be longer than that, about 10 years maybe.
Wow.
Okay. And then just prior to his death, our mutual friend, Peter McGuff, I don't know how we got back in touch. We hadn't spoken for about 20 years. And during the course of our conversation, I mentioned that I thought his profile on Mike that he originally didn't flex, later republished in Muscular Development, was the best piece on Mike I'd ever seen. And I knew that he had spent days, like about two hours a day for about 4 or 5 days straight interviewing Mike.
Wow.
Because I was in the office, and in the Weider building, there were cubicles. So I was sort of at the back, and Julian Schmidt was in front of me, and then Peter McGuff was at the other.
Okay.
And he told me he was going to interview Mike, and I remember lending him my copy of Jack Neary's contest report of the 80 Olympia, because I had that issue of Muscle and Fitness. Peter never gave it back very much, but he interviewed him, and then afterwards he gave me what he had typed out of the transcript of the interview. So I had that ever since 1995.
Okay.
But then recently when I was speaking to him, I said, hey, listen, I got a kind of a cool thing for Christmas where you convert cassettes to MP3. I'm doing it. I would love to hear the interviews you did with Mike. And in return, I'll make MP3s for you and send them to you. So he sent me his tapes. I made the copy, sent them back. And then sadly, Peter passed away like a month after or something.
Oh, man. Wow.
But anyway, I had this wealth of Mike Mentzer audio material.
Yeah. Yeah.
A lot of it was phone interviews. So the audio quality is not studio by any means.
Yeah.
But it was enough to allow Mike to tell the story in his own words. So
what year did he do the one with Peter?
I think it was 94 or 95.
Okay. And
probably it was 94. Cause I think Dorian had just won the 93 Olympia.
Okay.
And he'd won 92 and 93.
Right. That's and, right. Cause he does mention that on that tape. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and Mike had only been a personal trainer for 4 years at that point, started in 1990. Okay. And it was 1994.
Yeah.
So he was coming into his ascendant as a personal trainer, but it wasn't, you know, the very end or the last, you know, 2 or 3 years of his life. It was about 1994.
Okay. Gotcha. Yeah. I always liked hearing Mike talk, you know, and the few video clips I saw where he is talking, cause he's very well spoken and, you know, he's very intelligent guy. So it was great to hear those audio tapes and hear his whole story. He told his whole life story on these tapes. Yeah. That was really great to hear.
Well, what you might have appreciated more than most was his competitive history.
Yeah, absolutely.
Bodybuilding career, right? Because as a competitor yourself, you could relate on that level as well.
Yeah.
So, he was, as we discussed before, I mean, Mike was a fascinating, multifaceted, and he thought about exercise steadily and deeply. And unlike most bodybuilders who do whatever they do and look the way they do, and that's just the way it is, and that's the end of it, Mike was constantly looking for a better way. How can you trim out the unnecessary and retain the essential?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what he was all about right up until the end of his life.
Yeah.
And especially when near the end of his life, too, he was dealing with regular folk, like not the, you know, the genetically blessed
kind of the bodybuilders,
Or even guys that were no stranger to the needle. You know, I mean, he was dealing with just regular folk that were looking to get stronger and functional and put on some muscle or lose some fat or whatever.
Yeah.
So a lot of his later training was directed toward those people. You know, as he mentioned, it was what he would call softcore bodybuilding.
Yeah.
It wasn't, you know, that... And yet, by the same token, Dorian Yates did essentially the same program that he put these people on and looked phenomenal in 92 and 93. So it was a valid program, but people like me, for example, shouldn't go in there thinking they're going to morph into Dorian Yates. You know, it's not going to happen.
Yeah. So Mike was born in 1951. He's about 4 years younger than Arnold was. Same year as Lou Ferrigno and I think Danny Padilla, too. So that was a good year for bodybuilding. And he was born in Pennsylvania, and one of his earliest influences was his dad, who was just a truck driver. His dad wasn't someone who was a very illiterate guy or intelligent guy, but he really got a lot of influence from his dad.
Yeah, his dad was a very strong motivating factor in Mike's life. He was a staunch individualist and a man of integrity. As Mike said, you know, he would almost boast about his integrity, you know, doing the right thing.
Yeah.
And it rubbed off on Mike, certainly. And Ray, I guess, as well, to an extent, that they should be proud of what they do. They should stand behind their word and, that you should stand up for what you believe in. That was a big one.
Yeah.
No matter what the odds were. And, there's a lot of lip service to that. Mike is one of the few examples I can pull out who actually did it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, even when it cost him, you know, so, but yeah, his father was a big influence that way. And as he said too, he wasn't averse to a fight, but he wasn't academically oriented or anything, but in terms of principles, his father was very principled. And Mike carried that with him throughout his life.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting that he said that because, like you say, it sometimes it ruins your career when you're like that. But, you know, to be like that and be principled your whole life and stick to that.
Well, I mean, in some respects, it did ruin Mike's career.
Yeah.
After 1980.
Right.
When he saw what he perceived as a transgression of ethics, and he spoke out about it, you know, he got hauled in to the principal's office on a couple of occasions.
Yeah,
and had his knuckles hit with the ruler a few times, but he still went out into seminars and said the same thing. And to Mike, though, I remember him saying that, you know, if it can happen at this level, it can happen at the lower levels. And he said, and I get young bodybuilders coming up to me at Gold's every day, he said, and they're asking me, oh, should I compete? I don't know. And he said, it's very tough for me to answer those questions. He said, because, you know, on some level, there's corruption all the way through.
Right.
So
right.
He said, you know, what do I tell these kids? He said, I got to be honest with them.
Yeah.
And he was. And then once Mike was given two strikes, he was given a third and then he was out. You know, there were no seminars, there was no money. His income dropped from, as I may have mentioned before to you, about 200 to 300,000 a year back in 1979 to zero.
Wow. That's so money.
So, you know, here's a guy that, you know, you think bodybuilding is going to be your salvation and it's a noble enterprise. And then you see corruption and if you say anything about it, you're out.
Yeah.
You know, and so he, like you said, I don't accept this tacit code that is in bodybuilding that you can never say anything bad against it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So,
but anyway, I mean, that essentially ended his career in professional bodybuilding in terms of seminar bookings and competition. He wasn't going, that was his volition. He opted not to compete again, but
yeah,
the other revenue streams were sealed off. Appearance in the magazines was sealed off. But, you know, in a rare case of sticking to your principles and your guns and ultimately succeeding, when Dorian Yates came into the scene and started training along the lines of what Mike had advocated and was successful, suddenly there was a renewed interest in what Mike Mentzer had to say.
Yeah.
And then suddenly he was, I mean, his income was right back up to what it was in 79.
Right, right.
You know, so he, you know, faced the dragons, got scorched, but then came back and slew them, you know?
Yeah,
so it has a happy ending in some respect.
Yeah. Yeah. In a way. Yeah. So his dad really encouraged Mike intellectually. Like he, you know, Mike, it seemed like Mike was intellectually just, he was smart naturally, I guess. And, he was really into his reading and he got good grades at school. And his dad really encouraged that, even though, like I said, his dad wasn't a college student himself or a college graduate. But he encouraged that with his sons.
Yeah, he was very proud that Mike had done well academically.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of parents are like that. You want to see your kids do better than yourself.
Yeah.
And his father knew that, you know, he was driving a truck, probably not by choice, but that's what he had, right? He was, I think he was in the service. And then when he got out, you know, what do you do?
Yeah.
So he ended up driving a truck. I guess he was a hardworking blue collar kind of guy. And, but anyway, he was, when Mike started to excel in school, he was very proud, very happy about that.
Yeah.
And he would reward Mike. He'd, you know, if he got a good mark, he'd give him, you know, as Mike mentioned in the tape, you know, $20 one time, another time he got a baseball mitt.
Yeah.
So it was sort of a value for value exchange and almost an early, presentation of capitalism to Mike. If you do well, you work hard, you get rewarded.
Yeah.
And that's what that became a natural belief of Mike's, that if you work hard, you should be rewarded.
Yeah. And then we always talk about Mike's great genetics for bodybuilding, but in the tapes he talked a little bit about how he got into sports a little bit, playing around sports, and he was really like good. Like in his high school he was the best athlete for like a couple of years. So
I think it was like 3 or 4 years back to back.
Yeah.
Plus he was a football player and a swimmer, did well in track. He was a good athlete and he was the same way when he was in the Air Force. He was immediately made the captain of the physical fitness squad there because of his conditioning and natural athletic ability.
God, so, didn't he also do, like, remember they had those superstar competitions? He was in that one year, right?
With he was, I think it was 81 after the Olympia. He competed in there and just lost the swimming competition by a guy who was almost a professional swimmer. Like, it was like hundreds of a second difference between the two of them.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I remember talking to Mike about that. It was called the Superstars Competition.
Yeah.
And Lou Ferrigno was in it that year.
Yeah.
And they did the clean and jerk. And Mike pressed the same weight, but apparently Mike had broken his elbow at one point and couldn't quite get the full lockout of that arm.
Yeah.
So he got penalized for that, and Lou won that event.
Okay.
And then there was an obstacle course and swimming.
Yeah.
But he really enjoyed it. He said it was awesome to, you know, to compete against these other athletes.
And yeah.
At that time, to show them that bodybuilders were, you know, not just, you know, muscle bound or, you know, unable to do athletic things. In fact, he damn near won a couple of them. So that was pretty impressive. But
yeah, I remember Lou also did it, I think, in 76, the year after he competed in the Pretoria, South Africa Olympia. And he was downsized. He was thinner. But I remember he got a lot of press from that, you know, in the mass media. About how this bodybuilder did a really good job, and he proved that bodybuilders aren't muscle bound. And, you know, I remember Lou did good in quite a few events. I forget where he placed.
Yeah, Lou was a good athlete. I mean, he was up here in Canada and tried out for the Toronto Argonauts football team in Seattle.
Yeah, a lot of people forget about that.
Yeah. Yeah, and I spoke to a guy that was on the team actually recently about it. He said, you know what, he was pretty good.
Yeah.
I don't know why he didn't make the team, but
I think he hurt his Achilles tendon or something from what I
remember. But yeah. He impressed a lot of the guys that were at the tryouts. So Lou had good athletic ability as well.
Yeah, I think it was after that then he decided, I'm just going to go back to bodybuilding. That was in 77. And then he ended up not being able to do the Olympia because the Hulk thing came up, you know.
Yeah, the Hulk was crazy when that came out.
Yeah.
Everybody watched it. You know, it was Hulk and Iron and the Hulk. That was the two things you had to watch.
Yeah. So when Mike finally got into bodybuilding, it was the typical story of, you know, he's in the bookstore and he sees the bodybuilding magazine in the bookstore, like we've heard a million times from other people. Yeah. And I think, wasn't it Bill Pearl that he saw on the cover? That
was Bill Pearl.
Idol. Yeah.
Yeah. He saw Bill Pearl. I don't know what year it would have been. I think he was like 12 or 13.
Yeah.
So he was born in 51, would have been the early 60s.
Yeah.
And there's Bill Pearl on the cover. And Mike said it was a love affair right away. As soon as he saw it, all the other sports fell away.
He said like he knew exactly which I could relate to. I remember when I found out what bodybuilding was, I had the same feeling. It was like, that's it. That's what I'm going to do for the rest of my life, you know?
What was it for you?
What magazine or?
Yeah, what was it, a magazine or a TV show or?
I can't remember. Well, I can tell you what magazine I did buy. The first Muscle Builder was the one Mike was on the cover of.
No kidding.
Yeah. The one that he talks about in your interviews.
The 76 America one?
The one that Joe Weider discovered him in 75.
Yeah, the Russ Warner shot there.
Yeah, the Russ Warner shot, exactly. Yeah. That was the first Muscle Builder. And the first Iron Man I bought was Boyer Coe doing his arm pose.
Yeah.
I think that was from 76 too. So what happened with me was I had my parents bought me the weight training set because my original inspiration was Bruce Lee. I don't know if I ever told you that.
No.
But
I don't
Bruce
think
Lee was, because I was reading comic books, and then the first guy I ever saw that had a muscular physique was Bruce Lee. I saw him at a car show, and we went to go see the Batmobile, because I was a big fan of the Batman TV show.
Yeah.
And they had a car show in the Chicago area, and they had the Batmobile there, so I asked my dad if we could go. So we took the whole family, and I think I was probably like 12 years old, and they also had the Black Beauty car from the Green Hornet. And they had a big picture of Bruce Lee saying, in memoriam, Bruce Lee, 1940 to 1973.
Yeah.
And I was like, who is that? Because I never watched the Green Hornet. I always watched Batman.
Yeah, so you and me both. Yeah.
Yeah, so I forgot about Bruce being in the Green Hornet. And he was a picture from Enter the Dragon. He was so ripped. I'm like, he guy looks like a real-life superhero, you know, because I was a big comic book fan. And so I started reading everything about Bruce Lee. And one of the things he said he did was he worked out with weights. So then I asked my parents for a weight training set and they bought it for me for Christmas. So I was following the routine that was in there. It was a real basic 10 exercise routine. And then I wanted to do more. So I bought like a bench and then I started going to the health food store and I started looking at the bodybuilding magazines. And then once I discovered what bodybuilding was, I said, that's it. That's what I want to do, you know?
Yeah. I was the same way. Bruce Lee is the one that inspired me to even think about exercise or muscle development or anything like that.
Yeah.
And consequently, when I discovered the bodybuilding magazines. The bodybuilders that I was first that caught my attention and that it, I wanted to emulate were the thinner ones. Frank Zane, Steve Davis.
Yeah.
Those guys, Kozo Sudo.
Right.
From Japan. Right. I looked at those physiques and was like, yeah, it's kind of like Bruce. I like that. It's not too big. That was a biggie. And then Arnold came out.
Yeah.
We, of course, went and saw Pumping Iron.
Right.
And then that was it. Arnold was the guy, right?
Exactly.
Same his book me, yeah. came out, Education of a Bodybuilder, and that was the Bible.
Right.
And we went, on split routines off to Vic Tanny's or whatever gym we went to.
Yeah. Yeah.
All times were good. And then actually, I didn't even know about Mike Mentzer until 79. Moved up to where I am now in Muskoka. And there was a guy that I had no weights. The high school had no weights. And I was like, I got to work out. I got to do my Arnold program.
Right.
And this guy contacted the school and said he was looking for a training partner. And he had a complete weight set up in his basement.
Oh, wow.
I'm your guy. So I went over and he had a poster of Mike Mentzer up on the wall. And he had ordered Mike's courses. And he had an audio cassette from Mike telling him what to do and all this stuff.
Wow.
And I was like, Mike, who's he? Mike Mentzer.
Yeah.
Have you heard of Arnold Schwarzenegger? so anyway, he, said, well, I'm only going to train this way and blah, blah, blah. It's that or it's nothing. So, okay, heavy duty, here we come, And I started doing it, and then I read the stuff. And I had a friend in Toronto who was taking physiology. And I'd say, Mike Mentzer says this in his course. And he'd say, yeah, that's right. Oh, what about this? Yeah. And I was like, oh, the guy's on to something. So then I went and saw a seminar, and the rest was, history. Mike became the guy. And then when he lost the 80 Olympia, I didn't really care about the contest so much. I liked the training. I liked the shots of him training rather than on the stage.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew that what had just happened would now impact my ability to see more of this guy and learn more from him.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was, I begrudged the IFBB and Arnold and all the people I suspected were wearing black hats in the affair for what had happened. And of course I got to know Mike, and the bodybuilding competitive aspect dropped away even further in terms of being relevant, because like you and I, we could just sit down and talk.
Yeah.
And he'd tell me what he was thinking about training and what results a certain client had when they did this. And when he backed off on frequency, this happened. It was fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so much so that I remember telling him on numerous occasions, why are you still here? Like, why are you in California? You don't need to be here.
Yeah.
The bodybuilding thing's kind of, you've moved beyond that. Your name's well established. You could go anywhere.
Yeah.
And do other things as well. You've got this one nailed. You can always do the training, you can do the writing, you can do whatever you want, phone consultations, but do other stuff that you've told me you've always wanted to do, like write a novel or do that.
Yeah.
And he said, well, it doesn't have to be either or. He said, I like it here. I like it in California. I like what I do. So I couldn't twist his arm, but I was the Mike Mentzer in the later stages was sufficient in and of himself to me as a friend. He was, he didn't need to be at 3% body fat or competing in the next Mr. Olympia for me to respect him.
Okay.
He just had way more to offer. And it was more fun sometimes when we weren't even talking bodybuilding.
Yeah.
Like I remember going to his apartment when I moved to California to work for Joe Weider. I went there about a month ahead of my wife and, got the place picked out and everything. Mm-hmm. And then I had a lot of free time on my hands. So I was either going to bookstores or I was going to Mike's place. And so we were constantly together talking, shooting the shit. And
that's awesome.
Blah, blah, blah. And tell me about this guy and bodybuilding and what about training and what was your most productive routine? And and then it was off to the local liquor store and he introduced me to Grolsch beer, the one with the it's got a little like metal hinge on it that pops the top off.
Oh yeah. 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 I've seen those.
Never had it before. It's a bottle, weighs like a bowling ball.
Right.
It's not big. And Mike said, oh, you got to try this stuff. It's great. So we got a six pack of that, went back to his place. I think we had pizza. and watched a movie and again, just, you know, talking bodybuilding and whatever we wanted to talk about. It was a great time.
Yeah, I remember you telling me about that seminar in Toronto, and that was 1980. So you didn't really meet him until the very end of his competitive career.
Yeah, I met him. I went to two seminars of his, one in 1980 and one in 81. The one in 80 was about 6 months prior to the Mr. Olympia contest that year.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly enough, he was there with Franco and Arnold.
Yeah.
And they were, the three of them were doing this breakfast seminar. And then it was November 15th, 1981 was the next one I went to.
Okay.
So it was a year after the 80 Olympia.
Okay.
And it was actually just months after the 81 Olympia.
Yeah. Which I'm sure
and
you're talking about.
Ricky Wayne had written this sort of teaser report on this contest, and he was just eviscerating the IFBB in this piece. And Mike, of course, was like, yeah, go get him, Ricky.
Yeah, you know, right.
He read the whole piece to us at the seminar. It
was great. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
But he just made the point. He said, you know, Roy Callender said after the 81 Olympia, he said, I bet Mike Mentzer and Boyer Coe and Frank Zahner laughing their asses off back in California, you know, I told you so.
Yeah.
And he said, I wasn't laughing. I didn't think it was funny. He said, because you look at what could have happened to Tom Platz or Danny Padilla if they had won that contest.
Yeah.
He said, in Tom's case, he would have gone from being obscure to the biggest bodybuilder in the world.
Right.
He said, you're talking $300,000 or $400,000 a year.
Yeah.
He said, that's a man's livelihood. You're fooling.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the same with Danny, because Mike, as nice as Danny has been in his words about Mike since his passing on your show and other shows, Mike was equally as complimentary of Danny.
Mm-hmm.
He thought, you know, in terms of proportion, symmetry, mass, Danny Padilla was phenomenal.
Yeah.
Huge. I mean, he would have been in his top five bodybuilders of all time.
Wow.
And I did ask him who his top bodybuilders were, and he said number one was Sergio, no question.
Yeah.
Even ahead of Dorian.
Yeah.
And number two, which may surprise people, was Arnold.
Yeah.
He said, you know, all my personal stuff with Arnold aside, he said, I can still objectively assess his physique. He said Arnold and Sergio were vying for one and two the whole time.
Hmm.
You know, so he had great, you know, he was a bodybuilding fan himself. So he knew who, in his eyes, were the top bodybuilders.
Right, right. Yeah, you know what, another part of that interview that was really fascinating, John, was, and I remember Peter McGuff talking about Mike being at the 65 Mr. Olympia, the very first one that Larry Scott won in New York.
Yeah.
He was still in Pennsylvania, and I guess his dad set him up with a friend of his, right, that was into weight training. And so then Mike was training with that guy, and then I guess that guy took him to the 1965 Olympia, which Mike had to be like 14, right, when he saw that.
Yeah. Yeah, it was John Myers and Russell Herzog, and Herzog was a powerlifter.
Okay.
Myers was a guy who was – he had the gym. He had the garage gym that they trained in Pennsylvania when it was 20 below.
Right.
But, yeah, they took Mike to his first bodybuilding contest, and it happened to be the very first Mr. Olympia.
It's unbelievable. Yeah.
And, I mean, the cool anecdote there is that after the show, he snuck in – to the dressing room where Larry Scott.
Yeah, he climbed a fire escape or something and snuck in. He walks into the dressing room and Larry Scott and Dave Draper are there. That's great.
Yeah, it just blew his mind, you know, and then ended up going down in the elevator with him.
Yeah, yeah.
So you imagine being it'd be like you when you just started bodybuilding and you go into a dressing room and there's Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Right, right. It was like, wiping the oil off with a towel. Unbelievable.
Yeah. So, I mean, that really drilled it into Mike and then inspired him. And then he went back and he got his latest issue of Muscle Builder and wrote, you know, Mr. America, Mr. Universe, Mr. Olympia, and then the dates that he expected to win those contests.
Yeah. Do you remember what those dates were, John?
I never saw the magazine, and I don't think Mike ever indicated to anyone what the precise dates were. But I do know that he said that 79 would have been the year that he put down to win the Olympia.
Okay.
Because he wanted to be the guy that won it on his first try.
Okay. All right.
And so I guess you can back engineer it from there. So it's probably 79, 78 would have been the universe, which he did win.
Which he did, yeah.
Yeah, and then 77 probably would have been the America.
Right.
But he won it the year before.
Yeah. Wow.
So it's interesting how many perfect scores he amassed.
Yeah.
In listening to the tapes, I didn't know that he got a perfect score in the prejudging at the 79 Olympia. He got, I believe he had a perfect score in the 77 universe that he lost to Cal Scaller.
Yeah, I think you're right. And then Cal won in the post-down.
Yeah, won in the post-down, just like the 79 Olympia.
Yeah,
he also got a perfect score in the New York Night of Champions, his second professional show.
Okay.
He got a perfect score there as well.
Hmm.
That's not too bad, you know?
No.
So I was impressed. I hadn't realized there was a perfection line going through his what few contests he actually competed in. So
when he started competing, I think he was 18 when he did his first show, and this was before he ever used steroids and everything, but this just goes to show you the great genetics he had. He wins this Mr. Lancaster County, and he's like 18, so he's beating all these older guys, full-grown men, and he wins the whole show. And I saw some pictures of that. He looked really good.
Yeah.
And then the next year at 19, he goes into Mr. Pennsylvania, the state title, and he wins that at 19.
Yeah.
And then he goes to the Teenage America, and he gets second place in the Teenage America, but he won a lot of the body part awards.
Yeah. And then it was the America that Casey came out of. It was his coming out party.
That was the one Casey won. The Teenage America, though, I noticed Lou Ferrigno was in it.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's right.
Lou got like fourth or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, there was some good bodybuilders back then. And they looked good.
Yeah.
Like in the content, the lineup, they looked good.
Yeah.
You know, like Mike looked phenomenal.
Yeah. And that's wild that he thought enough of himself that he wasn't a Teenage Mr. America. And he goes, well, I'm going to do the Mr. America. So he goes into the Mr. America. There were probably like 45 guys in that contest.
Yeah.
And I think back then, because I talked to Padilla about this too, he said when he started doing the AAU shows, like the America and stuff, it was just one class. Like if you ever look at the results, it's just like they have 40 guys listed. They don't have like a short class, tall class. It's just one class. So Mike got 10th out of all those guys. And he took second to Casey in the best arms and best legs contest. And of course, Casey, I think, won all the body parts.
Won every body part. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's no small accomplishment. That's for sure.
Yeah, for 19 years old, it's unbelievable.
And that was when he, I guess a week or so later, he got the phone call from Arthur Jones.
Yeah, that was interesting too, because I guess Casey recognized Mike's potential.
Yeah,
and he went up to him, and coincidentally, they were the same age, which is pretty wild. You know,
19. I think Casey was a couple months older or something.
Yeah, yeah. And Casey dominates the bodybuilding world. That had to be so shocking to see some 19-year-old kid like Casey Viator.
That's what Mike said, too. He said, when this kid stripped off backstage, he said, I went through the roof.
Yeah,
that looked like Mr. Olympia.
If you look at the history of bodybuilding, that had to be one of the most groundbreaking events ever, you know, where a 19-year-old kid comes that advanced development and beats everybody in the country. That's crazy.
Oh, and the pictures of Casey there, he was huge.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely huge.
Yeah.
And it's, Casey, I probably never looked as good again in terms of mass and.
That's true. That's true. Because when he came back, in I think 78, when he did the Navi Universe, it wasn't that shocking of an impact like that.
No, not at all. No. Yeah. But like he looked smaller actually there. He was certainly probably more defined, as was the custom at the time.
Yeah.
But without the extra mass, he didn't have the same impact.
Yeah.
You know?
Boyer Coe was kind of like that, too. Boyer Coe, when he was a teenager, I guess was shocking. I talked to Ellington Darden, and Ellington said when he met him at a contest, I think Boyer was like 17, and Ellington was like in his early 20s.
Yeah.
And he's like, this kid was unbelievable. Like, he bench pressed more than Ellington did. And he said,
Boyer's an interesting guy. Because, like Mike, in a way, he's always got the antenna for any new thing, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I remember seeing pictures of Boyer forever,
Yeah.
And the old black and white ones taken in Louisiana or something like that. And his arms were astounding. His back.
I know.
His back was incredible.
Yeah.
And always had good legs.
Yeah.
And anyway, I remember we're coming back from some contest. might have been one in Olympia. I think there was an Olympia in Georgia, if I'm not mistaken.
Atlanta, yeah.
Yeah.
94.
Yeah, and I was covering that for Flex.
Okay.
And Boyer was on the same plane as me going back to California.
Okay.
And, you know, I was talking to some of the other reporters, and that's the odd bodybuilder. And Boyer comes over and plunks down next to me on the plane. And he goes, do you rate power factor training? I said, yeah. And I thought, well, here it comes. I'm going to get lambasted by Mr. Pro Bodybuilder, you know? And he goes, that's really interesting. I'd like to get a copy of that. You know, I read some of it and blah, blah, blah. And I was looking at him. And then I looked at myself. I thought, why? Like, why would you need anything, especially for me? You know? Boyer, when he's 90, will still look 100 times better than I do, you know, right. At my present age. So anyway, that was Boyer Coe. I mean, he was always learning, always interested in what was new,
right.
How he might be able to improve. I like Boyer a lot. He was very friendly.
And
you know, as you know, that's not always the case in bodybuilding. You know, most bodybuilders are looking over your shoulder to see who they need to speak to
to get
paid, you know. Yeah, how you doing, John? Yeah. But Boyer wasn't like that. So.
Right.
And I could see why Mike liked him. You know, Boyer was a value for value kind of guy. You know.
Yeah, he's always one of my favorite interviews. I love talking to him, and it's great now that I kind of know him as a friend too. You know, and I could. A while back, somebody sent me a message, and they said, "I heard Boyer Coe died," and I'm like, "Really?" So I'm looking on Facebook and stuff. I didn't see that. So then I call Boyer on his phone, and like 15 minutes later, he calls me back. "Hey, John, I'm sorry I couldn't get to the phone." I'm like, "Well, I just had to call you because somebody said that you died." He goes, "Man, these people need something better to talk about than worrying about if I'm dead or not." You know?
Oh, I know. Well, I mean, we heard that recently with Chris Dickerson too, right?
And
it was
like,
oh my God, you know, your heart goes in your throat and then you find out it was a false alarm. And
yeah, I know.
Whatever, but no, Boyer came up through a very interesting period of time. And as Mike described him, he's a gentleman.
You know? Yeah, he is. Totally.
There's very few of them around. So it's kind of last of a dying dynasty.
Yeah. Well, that's what I like when I interview him. He's just so honest, you know.
Yeah.
He's just so forthright, so honest, and he has great stories because he remembers all the details of what happened. And, you know, even if it goes back 50 years, he still remembers everything, you know.
Oh, yeah. No. Yeah. No, he's a good old boy.
So when Mike met Casey at this 71 America, and Casey said you need to – I guess Casey saw the potential in Mike, the genetic potential, and then he said you need to talk to Arthur Jones – So is that when Mike changed his training then? Because he was doing the traditional 6 days a week.
He was in the gym.
Body part.
He was in the gym. I think he said
three hours
a day.
Yeah.
6 days a week.
Right.
And then he spoke to Arthur, and he got – I think he came to the theory or to apply the theory of high-intensity training as Arthur Jones advanced it by steps. Because like most of us, the muscle magazines were – his constant.
Yeah.
This is what his heroes did, right? So he was going to do the same thing. But then he damaged his shoulder. He was doing dumbbell flies and I guess on the way down or something, he did something and did some severe damage to his shoulder to the point where he couldn't move his arm. So he wasn't able to train, I think for at least 18 months.
Yeah.
And then when he came back, I'm convinced, I never asked Mike this, but based on what he told me the program was, I think it was a program that Arthur Jones had written about for Ironman.
Mm-hmm.
It was called Some of the Problems and a Few of the Answers.
Okay.
Ellington Darden purloined it and put it in his advanced bodybuilding book in toto.
Okay.
But essentially what it was five or six exercises. Two sets each. And there were compound movements, chins, squats, overhead presses. And then you did that Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And when the gains slowed down, you cut back to only two such weekly sessions.
Okay.
And that's what Mike did essentially. So it was like I think he only did five exercises, two sets each. So 10 sets total twice a week.
Okay.
And he said, and within a couple of months, he was right back to where he was when he was doing the 3 hours in the gym thing.
Yeah.
And he started thinking, geez, maybe I could compete again, you know? Yeah. And so knowing that convinced him that doing less wasn't hurting him. It was actually got him to where he was before a lot quicker. Mm-hmm. And the volume had been cut down considerably. So he came back, he went to DeLand, Florida, and trained there actually for a while.
Okay.
With Casey. So this would have been in early after time. He got out of the Air Force.
Yeah, he went into the Air Force. How long did he go into the Air Force, John?
I think it was 3 or 4 years in the Air Force.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because when I was listening to these tapes, I was wondering if he had such a good physique at such a young age, and he took second in Teenage America and then he got 10th in the America, why didn't he just keep going? But then I forgot about the injury, so that's what's kind of sidetracked. Yeah. Then he went to the Air Force after that.
Yeah, and then he went to school when he got out of the Air Force. But he went down to Florida, spent a month or two down there.
Okay.
And then had to get work, so he went back to Washington. But he was there at the time when they had the unilateral vertical squat machine. You've seen pictures of that?
Yeah.
And apparently they had a fused foot pedal initially.
Okay.
So if you weren't real careful with your shoulder pads, it would catapult you right across the gym. Then they switched it to one leg at a time.
Right.
But Dave Mastroikas has some letters that Mike wrote him from this period, which he shared with me. And in it, Mike has sketched out this vertical squat machine. Says, oh, I got to try it. This is amazing, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
So at that point, he was very interested in Nautilus. When he went back to Maryland, there was the Spartan Health Club, I believe. And that was, they had 3 or 4 Nautilus machines and free weights and a Marcy circuit trainer, which is what Bruce Lee had in his home in Hong Kong.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. So he trained there. That was his gym, basically. And he started his whole body Nautilus routines at that point. So 3 days a week, Nautilus equipment. And then he was doing that right up to the Mr. America.
And wow.
So, okay. And then he was interviewed by Gene Mosé afterwards. And Gene Mosé couldn't believe that Mike only did, I think at that time, 3 to 5 sets of body part.
That was a magazine I got. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was kind of cool. And then after that, Mike started looking into issues like recovery, stress theory, like Ancelier and the GAS, and how that might apply to his training. And that's when he started to, number one, he went to a split routine at that point instead of whole body.
Yeah.
And he told me the reason for that was, he said, I was just too fatigued. He said, doing a whole body workout 3 days.
Yeah.
Especially full time, going to school.
Right.
But there were times he said, I didn't have the energy to get out of a chair.
Yeah.
So he cut it in half and he found that the fatigue factor was nowhere near what it was when it was a whole body.
Yeah.
So that was a plus. So he still did the 3 days a week. It was just upper, lower, upper.
Yeah.
Or et cetera, you know, and his sets were still around, I think all of his competitive careers, the sets per muscle group were in and around 5 probably.
Okay. Yeah. I remember Dorian said the same thing because Dorian was reading Arthur Jones' stuff too. Yeah. And he said he had to, you know, because Arthur Jones believes in the full body workouts, but Arthur Jones wasn't a competitive bodybuilder. So he wasn't taking into account all aspects of each muscle group, like the rear deltoids or, you know, the hamstring.
Yeah.
So you had to adjust it and add a few more exercises and then do a split routine in order for it to be effective. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the whole body routine, I think part of the problem with it, at least from Mike's vantage point, was if you give 100% to failure, which was the way you train, on, let's say you're starting with legs, which was the Nautilus way, biggest muscle group to smallest.
Sure.
By the time you've gone to failure on leg extensions and leg presses and squats and leg curls and standing calf raises, you don't have 100% left to give to back or chest or whatever. So he just found he could invest more intensity into the exercises for his upper body if he hadn't done legs ahead of time.
Yeah.
And the hole that he dug wasn't nearly as deep to recover from.
Yeah.
So that was
it's amazing too, how great his physique was as a teenager doing the traditional 6 days a week, you know, 25 sets.
Oh yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, there's, I mean, again, that was genetics too, though. But he had bumped up against a wall too. I think his top weight when he was doing that might have been in and around 185 pounds, maybe 190.
Yeah.
But, you know, he his last competition, he was 215. You know, so that's for an advanced bodybuilder, which he clearly was, even in the early shots, to put on that much more muscle. It shows that the something about the training approach he was employing, and perhaps even the rest period that he had been employing, was starting to pay dividends.
Yeah,
it was a variable that made a difference.
So when Mike went back into competition in 75, then he chose the IFBB because I think he was influenced by Weider's magazine, but also I'm sure by that 1965 Olympia and getting to see Larry Scott with that massive ovation. And he said when he went, I guess like you said, he was in the dressing room with Larry Scott and Dave Draper. And then the security came in and said, you guys got to get out of here. You got to clear the building. So then he went in the elevator with Larry Scott and Dave Draper down to the first floor. And then all these fans, you know, like I'm Jerry Branham. We had him on the show and he was talking about they had 100 people outside screaming like the Beatles, you know?
Yeah.
So he saw all that and he's like, this is what I want to do, you know?
Yeah. And here's Mike Mentzer, who's a nobody at that point, coming out of the elevator with the champions.
Right.
It was pretty heady stuff. But
because I think back then, I'm sure the AAU was still the bigger contest, but he said, I want to go IFBB. So he did the IFBB America, where Robbie won, and Roger Callard was second, and Mike was third.
Yeah, and he, I mean, you can tell, too, from the tapes, the respect he held Robbie in.
Yeah.
He really, I mean, he in the conversations we had when Robbie's name came up, he had nothing but good things to say about Robbie Robinson.
Right.
And not just in terms of his physique, which we all know was incredible, still is actually. But his character, he thought Robbie was, you know, a straight up guy, you know. And I mean, Robbie's got quite a backstory too. I mean, his Vietnam story is scary.
I know.
I mean, he went through a lot, but
it was also cool. Like when you notice all these things happening in Mike's life, like Casey coming up to him, and then that's how I got introduced to Arthur Jones. And then while he was at the 75 America, Joe Weider was there, and he was freaked out that the master blaster himself was backstage. And Joe Weider was staring at him and then came up to him and said, you know, basically recognized the potential and then asked him to do a photo shoot that Monday after the contest. And that led to his first magazine cover with that Russ Rohrer photo we were talking about.
Yeah. And the feedback apparently was incredible. Because Joe immediately reached out to Mike to get more articles about training from him because the mail that came in was incredible. And
I remember that reading that as a kid, and Gene Mose, who did the interview, was like, well, you know, he's asking about his training. Well, how many, what do you do for your chest and stuff? And he's like, well, I do 5 sets. He goes, for the exercise? And he goes, no, 5 sets total. He goes, what? You know, I couldn't believe
it.
I only train 3 days a week, and I only do 5 sets of body part. And everybody back then was doing 25, 30 sets of body part, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, it was that, and it was a breath of fresh air. And I think even for the fans, people like myself, you know, there's nothing we wanted more than to look like those guys.
Yeah.
That was the kid's dream, right?
But,
you know, Mike came in at a time when Arnold had the center stage for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
He was the guy, and everybody had bought something of Arnold's, whether it was his courses or went to a seminar or his book when it came out. And we all tried to do that in the gym. We did it as best we could.
Yeah.
But most of us found that the 20 sets of body part, I mean, we weren't on juice or anything, so obviously we were going to flame out pretty quick.
Right.
But we were, you know, we were just like most young teenagers. The hormonal environment was good that we noticed a difference doing this training after about 2 or 3 months. It's like, but it wasn't a linear process. It was like, hey, I think I'm starting to, it's over.
Yeah, you know, that was, initial person.
That was such a And so it was like, damn, you know, like I remember taking a bus downtown Toronto. It took me an hour and a half to get from where I live to the gym and to do that 6 days a week. And, you know, go in there and bust my ass, yeah. working out. And yeah. at some point, you know, even I at that age said, is it really worth the time? Because, yeah. you know, the first couple of months were pretty good, but yeah. I'm not seeing too much right now. And then suddenly Mike came in and was saying, well, you don't need to train that often.
Yeah.
Hello, what? Not only did you not need to train that often, but you'll get better results if you don't train that often.
Right, right.
Oh, okay, I'm in. You know, where do I sign up for that? So
Mike continued then writing articles for Joe after that initial article, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, okay. Mike, apart from Rick Wayne, to my knowledge, was the only bodybuilder that wrote his own articles. That's why Joe had a staff.
Yeah.
That's what we did.
You know? Right, right.
You need Brian Buchanan's arm routine. Okay. Yeah. Well, you know, you call Brian and he gives you a schematic and it's like, okay. And then someone else writes it. Even Arnold. I mean, Jack Neary wrote Arnold's courses. I think he wrote Omni's too, he said.
Yeah.
So it's just, you know, their thing was bodybuilding. They did it. It's like the old adage, those that can do, those that can't teach, you know, the office was packed with a lot of teachers, you know, because we couldn't be bodybuilders.
Right.
So,
Mike, at this time, then he's after that 75, he still stayed in Washington and he was still going to school and all that. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. He was a pre-med program.
Really, really hard that winter, I guess. Him and Ray were training really hard to go into America again.
Yeah,
I think he realized this is his shot at fame. Yeah. You know,
And to his mind, the Mr. America was the most satisfying contest win he'd ever had.
Yeah,
I remember him telling me that he, before the contest, he would be awake just staring at the ceiling as if it was a movie screen, and he could see himself getting the trophy and all the hard training and you know, from age 14, the desire to be Mr. America to win it.
Yeah.
He said the feeling was unbelievable. He said he actually had to fight back tears when he won the contest.
Wow.
And he said no other contest, including the 78 Universe, which he won with the first and only perfect score, came close to it. He said it was it was almost anticlimactic, he said, after the America.
Yeah, I remember when he said that in the magazines about it, after winning that Universe, about how it being anticlimactic, you know, and I was like, that's a strange thing for someone in that position to say. This guy just won the Universe. He's one of the most celebrated bodybuilders right now. Yeah. And he said it was like a feeling of disappointment. But
yeah,
well, I think that's a feeling that a lot of us can relate to, a lot of us who competed, you know?
Well, yeah. I mean, you would know better than I on that. I'm sure there's certain contests that were a rite of passage.
Yeah.
Yeah, I nailed it. And then other ones were like, yeah, okay, it's nice to have won it.
Yeah. But
it doesn't feel the same as that one did.
Yeah. Yeah, I think in every bodybuilder's career, no matter how far they go, there's that one event. I think I asked Dorian this when I interviewed him, and I think for him it was the first contest he did? The first real contest he did, I think it was in 1985 in England, and it was just a novice contest. And the judges were like, what are you doing? And you're way better than – you're like one of the best heavyweights in the country. But for him, I remember asking him this, and this is after he won 6 Olympias – That was the most significant victory for him, was that first one, because it was the most meaningful and it really felt like you really arrived and you had it, you know?
Yeah. I think that's what the America was for Mike. And well, I know it was because he told me that, but it was also the springboard into big time bodybuilding. You had to win that contest to even be considered for that. And if you won that contest, you were in, you're part of the club. You're a champion, right? And and in the IFBB, I believe, too, at that point.
And how much bigger was he, John? Wasn't he like 17 pounds or 14 pounds heavier than the year before?
I want to think he was I don't know that he was 200 pounds, but he'd been close to it.
Okay.
So probably 198, 197 or something. So he would have been up, I don't know, 10 pounds, 12 pounds.
Yeah, he said 14 pounds. I wrote it down.
14 pounds. There you go. Yeah,
that's crazy.
Yeah. Well, so they would have been 204.
Wow.
14 pounds. So that's significant. That's a fair amount of mass. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was, I think his next contest after that, wasn't it the 77 Universe in Nimes?
He did the 76 Universe in Montreal with Rob.
Montreal. That was it. Yeah, that's right. And Robbie won that one.
Yeah.
And Mike said he knew Robbie was going to win that one.
Yeah, yeah.
As soon as he saw him backstage, yeah.
But he said in the interview that a couple of the guys that were there guest posing, like Lou Ferrigno and Boyer Coe, they came up to him afterwards and they said, man, you really look great. You know, you could
win.
It's really close between you and Robbie, you know.
Yeah, yeah, it was. But as Mike said too, you know, he wasn't disappointed that he lost to Robbie.
Right, right.
You know, he said not only did he think he looked better, but he said he was already getting the publicity in the magazines.
Yeah.
You know, so there was – Robbie was a star on the rise.
Yeah.
And Mike was just kind of creeping up into the firmament there at that point. He wasn't –
Yeah, Mike had just sort of established his name. When I interviewed Jack Neary, that was the first big contest that Jack covered, was that 76 America in New York. And he was really talking a lot about Mike, too. He's like, well, that was the one where Mike came out. And he was the big name, you know.
Yeah. Well, he looked good from the photos.
Yeah.
That shot of him where the sartorius muscle is
revealed. Yeah, yeah.
And his abs, he had small waist, he had big shoulders, yeah. Square chest. Looked
yeah.
Great. Like, yeah. He looked really, really, really good.
Yeah. And he beat a good lineup. He beat Roger Callard, he beat Danny Padilla. You know, he beat a lot of good guys in that show.
Yeah, well, Mike was a complete bodybuilder. I mean, mm-hmm. There weren't really any weak points on his physique. And then I know that a lot, not a lot, but certainly the knock on Mike is that, oh, yet his pecs weren't very big.
Right.
But, man, I've seen photos where his pecs look huge.
Yeah.
Huge. The upper pec is every bit the equal of Franco Colombo's.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And it was like, I think there might be a little bit of nitpickiness going on there. You know, he truly had, and very few people do, a Mr. Olympia caliber physique.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's not many that have it. You know, there's lots that compete for the title and a few that win the title.
Yeah.
But to actually be up there and not have people go, that's something, you know?
Yeah. I've got a videotape from Wayne Galash, and it was taken the next year in 1978. And that was, they had a, it was the Mr. USA contest, and then they had the pose down for the for the Universe team. So Danny Padilla was there, even though he wasn't in the Mr. USA. Cal Scalak went in the USA, and he won it easily. They kind of made Cal go in it because Cal was the 1976 AAU America winner, and they said, well, if you want to come in the IFBB, you got to do an IFBB contest. So then he went into that Mr. USA, and he beat everybody real easily. And then they had the pose down to figure out who was going to be part of the team. So they had Danny there and they had Mike there. And so I'm watching this tape and you're seeing guys like, you know, Dave Mastorakis, John Burkholder, maybe Steve Reed, I think was another really top amateur.
Yeah, yeah, I remember him. Yeah.
Yeah, like the top amateurs in the IFBB at the time.
Yeah.
But then you see Mike and you're like, whoa, it's like a whole other level. Like when he put his arms up, his body just explodes. You know? Same thing with Cal. You can say the same thing with Cal and Danny. They were just on another level. They just.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Yeah, definitely. Cal, I remember the first cover of Muscle and Fitness that he was on. It was a split cover.
Yeah, I remember.
He was doing a double bicep on the top one. And
his
biceps were like.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Like I'd never seen. Like Arnold had a peak bicep like Cal's.
Yeah.
Arnold only had one.
Right.
The one arm was flat. The other one was a little flatter.
Right.
And Cal had the two.
Yeah.
And Robbie does too, actually, sort of the two peaks.
Yeah.
And it was stunning when you saw that photo. Like it just arrested you in your tracks to think,
right.
Oh my God. They look like cancerous growths.
You know? Right.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. When I was a kid, I was training at a gym and there was a guy there. His name was Jim Julian. And Jim had spent time in California. He lived in California for like a year. I think it was like 1977. And that was the year that Cal beat Mike at the Universe. So he said he would train at Gold's Gym and he would see Cal training there. He said, this guy would do 500 pounds on the bench, like nothing. Like he said, it looked like the weights were made out of styrofoam. That's how he was doing it, you know. But he said when he would do front squats. And he said his biceps were so big they were almost hitting his head, his chin, you know. His biceps were so massive, you know.
Yeah, he was, you know, until his falling out with Joe.
Yeah.
you know, and I mean, he didn't have the lower body development to match the upper body.
Yeah, yeah, I know.
But man, he had a very marketable physique, that's for sure, in bodybuilding.
Yeah. And he was always in shape too. I mean, every show I saw him in,
oh yeah,
or I saw the pictures of, he was ripped. You know, he was shredded for all that size, you know.
Yeah, Mike respected Cal too. You know, he said there was no shame in losing to Cal Scouter. You know,
yeah. So. That's the one thing I liked about those interviews you sent me, John, with Mike, is that he gave respect to everybody. You know, he wasn't like, oh, Cal should, because there was a lot of controversy when Cal beat Mike at that 78 Universe.
Yeah.
I guess Kathy Gelfo, Mike's girlfriend, was really, you know, she's like, he lost a half a body, you know. But like, you never heard Mike say any disparaging remarks about the guys that beat him. He said, these guys are all great athletes. I'm competing against the best. So, you know, it's no shame in losing to these guys.
Well, even in the his third professional show, you know, they're interviewing him backstage in New York.
Yeah.
The guy said, well, you know, the competition's really between you and Robinson. He said, no. He goes, these are all, anybody can win this. He said, they're all great athletes out here.
Right.
And corrected the guy. You know, so that was, but that was Mike. He was objective. He wasn't doing it to, you know, to be a nice guy or to come across in a certain way. It was just, that was the honest answer. Yeah. All these guys, you know, and they wouldn't be here if they weren't, you know, so it's a competition between all of us. So that was good. So, and that's also what made his reaction to the 80 Olympia more meaningful. If he had a history of grousing after every loss, then it would be sour grapes.
Right.
But, oh, here we go again. You know, another, oh, whose fault is it now, Mike? You know, but that was never the case.
Yeah.
And, in fact, he, all the contests he'd lost in the past, he said essentially, I deserve to lose them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then 80, when that went down, he never came out and said I should have won, but he said there was corruption.
Yeah.
And that didn't play well. And as we talked about, and as Danny Padilla has mentioned too, was, I think it was the loss of, almost like the loss of your religious faith for Mike.
Mm-hmm.
Because bodybuilding, from when he was a kid and saw that magazine, that was his religion. That was his everything. You mm-hmm. know, that was noble. It was pure. It was developing your body to its maximum and you know, seizing every minute of life to improve yourself, whether mentally or physically, and seeing what your potential is as a human being.
Yeah.
And if you really work hard, you know, there are these rewards on these staging posts on your journey that will mm-hmm. inspire you to continue the journey. And then, you know, when you get to the top of the ladder and it's the Wizard of Oz, and it's really just a big can of protein powder that's for sale. It's like, what the hell? You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Been climbing the wrong ladder.
So after Mike wins at America, then John, he still is in Washington, right? And he doesn't go to California yet, but even though Joe wanted him to come work for him, right?
Right. Yeah. No, he wanted to continue in school.
Yeah.
And I think he might have continued in school for quite a while, but for the fact that he just didn't have any money.
Yeah.
You know, he was at school. Every penny was going into school. He had a girlfriend he was trying to see. He was working part time for the stress.
He was studying pre-med, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you know, the temptation of the offer that Joe had made to him: come out to California. I will pay you a stipend. You can train and you can write articles.
And you can live in sunny
California. Suddenly look pretty good. You know, suddenly look like that's not a bad deal. So right. I think he went out fairly tentatively. But then once he hit California, he was like, yeah, this is where I want to be.
Yeah.
This is what it's all about. You know, so that's what he ended up doing and staying, and he never went back.
Yeah. And one of the contests he talked about, which I'm glad he talked about, because this is a contest I rarely have heard anything about, and I never saw any contest coverage. But he did a show in 1977, so this was the year after he won the America. He did that North America, which was the IFBB North America, and it was in British Columbia, right? Vancouver, British Columbia.
Correct, yeah.
And he beat Darcy Beckles, who was a great bodybuilder. Yep. And I think there's a picture of Mike where he's just standing relaxed. You know what I'm talking about, the black and white one? He looks
That's the one.
Easy. Yeah.
Yeah, that's from that show.
And they always said it was from the North American. I'm like, man, I never saw pictures from that North. That was the only picture I ever saw.
Yeah.
So he talked about that contest, and he talked about how he won that show. And
he looked like a tank. Yeah.
Yeah, and he must have looked amazing for that contest. He even said in the interview how great he thought he looked.
Yeah. Yeah, he was impressed with it. And, yeah, that's a very famous photograph of Mike.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite photos of Mike.
Yeah, and yet there's very few photos from that contest.
I know.
You know, there was but I do have video that was shot by the CBC about the contest. So that's pretty cool. Yeah. I'll shoot you a link.
Okay.
But it was cool to see Mike. He was in great shape. I mean,
yeah, he was.
Great shape.
Fantastic shape.
Yeah. So that was the last contest he competed in while living on the East Coast. And then it was California thereafter.
Yeah. So then right after that, he goes to California. He starts working for Joe, and he's in the magazines all the time. And then he's the favorite to win the Universe that year, which is in Nîmes, France.
Right.
That's the one we were talking about where he went up against Cal, and then Cal beat him in that controversial. And like you said, John, I forgot, he did score a 300 perfect score in the prejudging. And then at the night show, they kind of disregarded the prejudging scores, and they judged it on a placement system. And I think Cal won by one vote over Mike.
Yeah, that's right. So that was an eye opener for Mike. He actually said, you know, Cal was in better shape. You know,
yeah,
really. It was great that he got a perfect score and everything, but he didn't. I don't think he would have felt right. Would have been accepted, of course, but I don't think he would have felt right if he'd won it.
Yeah. Mike was better balanced, but I think Cal was in better condition.
He was harder for sure.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, but Mike knew that was the wake up call that if he didn't get his act together and win the Universe in 78, that he could kiss his bodybuilding career goodbye.
Because he had two losses already now at the Universe. He lost to Robbie and then he lost to Cal. So,
and he said, you know, the judges don't forget that. Right. Yeah. You're the guy who got third place. Yeah. So, anyway, he did, and he won the Universe the next year in Acapulco with a perfect score, which carried over into the finals. And that represented probably the peak of his competitive career, because everything started to happen all together at once at that point.
You know,
By 79, he had a poster, he had a book deal, a two-book deal.
Yeah.
He was appearing on television shows to promote the book, like Merv Griffin, Mike Douglas.
That's wild.
He was crazy. In GQ magazine.
Wow.
So, I mean, next to Arnold, no bodybuilder had that kind of exposure. So his star was like Zoom.
And Arnold was retired at this point, so it was Mike that was in the magazines. Mike was the next upcoming guy, right?
Mike was the guy, And he had I don't know if it ever equaled Arnold's following, probably not, but he had a big following.
He had
very loyal people that were very much supporting him and bought anything that Mike put out, would go to his seminars, you know. And he was very popular. He was the anti-Arnold, and it's just human nature. If someone has it, you know, too good for too long, there's a schadenfreude, you know, there's a resentment. You want to see him taken down a notch.
Yeah, we see it with the Mr. Olympia guys all the time.
All the time. And I think there's a bit of that with Arnold. You know, like everyone loved him. He was very charismatic and tremendous physique. But it was Arnold every month in the magazines.
Yeah.
Arnold, 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 Arnold.
Yeah.
And then if it wasn't an article praising him or an article by him about his whatever, calf routine, it was about his contest that he and Jim Lorimer were promoting, the Mr. Olympia.
Right.
And then you turn the page and there he is selling, you know, Weider mega shakes or whatever the hell Joe was hawking at the time.
Right.
You couldn't get away from him. It was, you know, 50 pages of any magazine was Arnold. And anyone who was interviewed praised him.
Yeah.
So it was Arnold, 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 Arnold. And then out of left field comes this guy with a perfect score in the Mr. Universe contest, who's training three times a week for 30 minutes a pop.
Yeah.
He says, you know, if Arnold's methods worked and everybody uses Arnold's methods, why aren't there more Arnold Schwarzeneggers running around?
Right. Which was Mike.
That was the alarm, right? Who is this guy? So people liked that breath of fresh air that came in.
Mm-hmm.
It was a guy that wasn't towing the line. He wasn't kowtowing to Arnold, lighting candles at his shrine. He was he was thinking for himself, and he seemed to be a formidable person to want to engage in a debate about training.
Yeah.
So he got a lot of respect. And then when word started to come into the magazines that it pissed Arnold off, well, that was all the more reason to get behind Mike, right? Because
he
got
a he was an intelligent guy. He was good looking. He looked great in photographs. Plus, he had the great physique. Now he was having the great career.
Yeah.
So you could see Arnold, getting a little jealous of that, you know?
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, and in fairness to Arnold, I mean, he couldn't have anticipated how well he was going to be received.
Right.
But when you do, and you have it good, you don't like anything that's going to disrupt the way things are going.
Yeah.
And when you start getting questions, well, you know, Mike Mentzer says I don't need to train. It's like, well, who is this guy? Get out of here. And so there was that, and he didn't like Mike. He didn't like the fact that Mike was not saying, "Oh, Arnold's anything he says about training is sacred scripture."
Right.
But saying quite the opposite. You know, question everything, including what Arnold says.
And
That didn't play very well with Arnold and his group.
Also, now that you bring that up, John, I forgot that story he said about the 76 America. He said every judge there gave him first place except Arnold.
Really?
And Arnold gave Roger Callard, who was his training partner.
Absolutely.
And that kind of reminded me when I did the interview with Danny Padilla. He said, Arnold, I don't think Arnold was a judge that year, but Roger was favored to win. And then Danny came in from New York a couple weeks before the contest, and doesn't even have a tan. He's chewing gum at the prejudging, and he ends up beating a Roger Callard. And then he goes in the back and he's showering, and then they make him come back and they go, "We got to do the pose down over again because Roger's protesting."
I know. Yeah. You've got to find some way to get this guy a victory because Danny dominated.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Well, I remember Mike saying that one of his friends was at the contest that he won, but that Arnold didn't vote for him. And when Callard came off the stage, Arnold said, "Mentzer just blew your shit away." That's what he said. Well, he was pissed at Callard. Yeah.
Wow. Wow.
Even though he didn't vote for him.
Right.
He still recognized that there was a problem. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's funny, you know, I mean, the Arnold Mike thing is a very interesting dynamic because he was his hero at one point, just because he was a bodybuilding fan. Right. So Arnold was the guy, and they did seminars together at George Snyder's, and Albert Busick flew him over to Germany, and Arnold and he were together there. And, but, you know, Mike said, I never said anything bad about him as a person. I just disagreed with the training approach.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
And, but that was, you know, in bodybuilding and in the bodybuilding industry, that's business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you came on your podcast and said every book John Little wrote is a piece of shit and, you're going to end up looking like a jockey, that hurts my business. You know?
Right,
so
right.
If someone said, "Hey, what do you think of John Hanson?" Well, not my favorite guy right now, but I mean, that's just the nature of it. Right.
Right. Right.
So there was that Arnold didn't like about Mike because he was the only bodybuilder that wasn't basically training by ritual, doing what they did because Arnold did it. And Arnold did what he did because Reg Park did it, and on and on.
Yeah.
He was a guy that thought for himself and figured out he didn't need to train that much, didn't, got good results, and shared the fact that I got good results not doing what this guy did.
All right. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thanks again to John Little for that great interview. And join us next week for part two of our interview with John, where we talk a lot more about the late Mike Mentzer on the 20th anniversary of his death. I also want to thank our Patreon donors for contributing every month to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I want to thank Florida Alternative Medicine for sponsoring this episode of the podcast again. If you guys are interested in being a Patreon donor yourself, you can just go to bodybuildinglegendshow.com website, and on the upper right-hand corner, you'll see the link to be a Patreon donor. And I try to contribute to you guys who help me on Patreon. I send you some short interviews, some clips of our interviews that I don't show on the podcast or on YouTube. So these guys get exclusive interviews, some little clips of the interviews I've done. And I send those out to our Patreon contributors each week. So that's something you get from helping out with the show. Also, if you guys are interested in the audiobook of my book, Bodybuilding Heroes and Legends, Volume 1, just go to the website, bodybuildinglegendshow.com, and you'll see it right there on the front page. You can purchase the audiobook, which is narrated by me, and you can hear the whole book on your phone or on your laptop. All right. I want to read this article by Jack Neary, which was in the January 1977 issue of Muscle Builder and Power. And this was the big contest that Mike Mentzer won, the 1976 American Bodybuilding Championships. And it says, Mike Mentzer, the man who came in from the cold, wins. Danny Padilla didn't want to come off as one of those I told you so sort of guys. But as much as he was trying not to, he was. He was right, though, about Mike Mentzer, whom we had all taken quite lightly. Except Danny and Joe Weider, of course. Look, the smoky-eyed fire plug reminded us. Didn't I tell you Mentzer would be the man to watch? And didn't I also say that if Roger Callard was the best they had, then I'd already have won? Yes, he did. He was referring to the Mr. America contest, or as it had come to be known in the argot of the sport's new public image, the American Bodybuilding Championships, which had just ended minutes before at the spacious Felt Forum in Madison Square Garden, New York City. Mike Mentzer, if Thornton Wilder will pardon me, nipped Padilla for the overall title by the skin of his teeth. Only a half point separated them. While it was not announced in what order the runner-ups finished, it was assumed that Roger Callard placed third and George Navarrete fourth. Sure, we had heard of Mike Mentzer. Hell, he even made the cover of this magazine not too many issues ago, which, as he tells it, was tremendous inspiration for me. After Joe Weider put me on the cover, I improved at least 95%. The last 2 months, I have been a completely different person. A different energy force has manifested itself within me. All I could think about was Callard and Padilla. Yes, this was the same Mentzer of whom we were startled to read his training methods. The guy who trained every body part in one day, maybe five sets per or three times a week. Strange and nutty stuff. And then he said something to the effect that he would beat Arnold in a year. Well, I may have been a little carried away over that one, he admits. But as you can see, the improvement since last year is very good. Winning the Mr. America has been a lifetime goal for me. Let's get back to before the contest. Several bodybuilders, including Callard, Padilla, and Mentzer, were sitting quietly in the dressing room somewhere in the bowels of Madison Square Garden. Your correspondent admits to not knowing who the massive guy in the blue sweatsuit was. He was Mentzer. It was very bright in the dressing room. Most of the guys were just sitting there looking at their hands, not saying much. Ken Covington turned to Callard. Hey, man, just wait until you see me this year. I've got something special for you. When you see me, you better be worried. I don't know why he picked Roger to deliver those well-rehearsed lines to, but Keller's reply came such, yes, I don't like my prey to be worried. Yeah, you look good last year, and you've got to work on those calves. Get yourself some calves. With that, Callard pulled his pant leg up and revealed a giant flex parasite hanging from his shin. Then he said, somehow my calves just don't want to grow. Mentzer looked down at Callard's sharply pronounced diamond and said, that's not a calf, that's a cow. Which was an apt metaphor because when calves grow, they soon become cows. At this point, I was not aware that this chap was Mentzer, although Callard and Padilla were. But my attention was immediately directed to Mentzer when a contest official asked for his measurements, and he said his arm taped 20 and a half cold and calves 19. Say what? This bit of information, these rather awesome statistics coming from the mouth of Mike Mentzer, must have set off some sort of reaction in the minds of all of his competitors sitting about the room, trying not to notice. The official who was studiously taking all this down on his clampboard stood up and said, thanks, Mike. Then came the dawn. The fog inside my skull began to lift. So this was Mike Mentzer. If the rest of the short class competitors had known that Danny Padilla reached the shape he was in only 7 weeks, they may very well have broken down and cried. As it was, without this knowledge, perhaps it was a bit of a chore holding back the tears. For Padilla looked simply unbeatable. Even then, Padilla wasn't in top shape for the Mr. America, and he says so. I started training for this about 2 weeks too late, he said over pizza that evening. I think that another week or so of dieting and I would have caught Mentzer. I was just a little too smooth. But how can you take anything away from him, Mentzer? The guy looked fantastic. He was big and he was cut. He deserved it.
In the short class lineup at the prejudging, Padilla, normally inconspicuous because of his size, stuck out like a shaved cat. Weighing 178 at a height of 5'3", this man drew a lot of double takes from the judging panel. Arnold Schwarzenegger was one of the nine judges. Before long, his natural leadership tendencies began taking over, and it was apparent the rest of the panel were looking to him as the voting trendsetter. Schwarzenegger, for one, didn't think Padilla could train for top shape in only 7 weeks. Padilla would have to rocket from a wispy 148 to a weight some 25 pounds heavier and still maintain a semblance of definition. Once again, Padilla was looking every bit the "I told you so" sort of guy he is. But the proof was in the pudding this round. Schwarzenegger was visibly impressed when Padilla paraded only a few feet before the panel, flashing a pair of the most praiseworthy thighs and calves one has ever seen. "When I saw that gleam in Arnold's eye," grinned Padilla, "that made me feel good. I knew I had proved myself. Arnold said I couldn't do it." While Padilla had every right to appear joyous or at least pleasantly confident during his short class pose down, he seemed rather sad. So contrary to the vitality he displays in everything else he pursues. Why? "I don't know why I don't smile when I'm up there posing. I guess I should. I'll remember that." Padilla's closest competitor in the shorts was the seasoned Carlos Rodriguez of Tucson, Arizona. Rodriguez had promised a challenge for Padilla a month before when they talked at the Mr. USA in Oakland, California, which Padilla more or less brushed off, and he had a reason to. Rodriguez looked wide, and he had a remarkable rear lat spread, but what he has going against him isn't as much a muscle thing as it is a structural problem. Simply proportion. He has a long neck and legs and very short torso, and somehow the combination appears out of kilter. If that wasn't going to damage the guy's chances, then his relative smoothness would. While Rodriguez wasn't good enough to upset Padilla, he was good enough for second in the short class. Dave Mastorakis of Maine snatched third place in a tight race with Washington's John Burkholder in fourth. The medium class proved considerably more tense. This was obvious from not only looking at the top two athletes, Menser and Callard, but the judges kept the lineup posing for many more minutes than the shorts. Mike Menser created a small sensation amongst the sparse gathering at the prejudging. The evening show performance had a crowd of about 2,500 literally sucking in gulps of air in amazement. He was every bit as thick as he was reputed to be and more. I'd been spending much time with this contest with Roger Callard, quietly marveling at his condition and wondering how anyone could possibly beat him for medium class honors. Going into the competition, I was partial to Perdia for the overall. But next to Menser, Callard looked thin. Please allow for hyperbole. Nevertheless, in terms of muscle size and thickness, Menser breezed the class. Callard, who had been dieting strictly the past week, appeared to have smoothed out thanks to an improperly gauged zero-carbohydrate diet. 2 days before, in his Santa Monica apartment, Callard whipped off his jersey and displayed an intricate network of cuts, striations, and veins zigzagging freelance across his golden set of lumps. But in a last-second quest for an extra cut or two, the poor guy went flat, and it showed oh so sorely at the prejudging. Menser's done a remarkable job with a body that is marred with a few flaws, such as a peculiar calf shape, a curious curve to his thigh sweep, and a chest which, quite honestly, could be deeper. But great mother of creeping leather, you have to see the horizontal strands of rope running across his swollen triceps. I've seen steers with less meat than what Menser was showing us. Callard clearly won out in the back poses, them being his forte, but after losing to Roger two times before, Mike Menser looked every inch a winner. "Every rep I did in training was spurred on by the thought of beating both Callard and Padilla," said the 24-year-old pre-med student from Washington, D.C. "I would love to come out to California and train with Joe Weider and his superstars and then maybe turn professional in the next 2 years, but there's no way work or school will allow it." Bob Smith, a Californian, placed third in the class. Fourth spot went to a fast-improving Charles Thomas of New Jersey. At only 21 years of age, Florida's George Navarrete is what any cowboy would call a greenhorn. But for a guy who is still wet behind the ears, Navarrete has burst onto the American muscle scene in the past few months with the flourish of a cyclone. He has already won the support of muscle main man Schwarzenegger, whose telling influence over the judges panel earned Navarrete the inevitable tour de force of winning the most muscular award. "I told the judges to watch this kid's most muscular pose. It looked that good," explained Schwarzenegger. "After they saw that pose, we all decided unanimously." Armand Tanney has, over the years, seen them all. His impression of Navarrete lacks the insouciance or indifference of a man who has endured at least three decades and probably more around this iron-pumping subculture. This kid has got the makings of a great champion, the perceptive writer remarks. Fantastic shape, great coloring, good looks. Navarrete is definitely the man to watch. He will likely prove to be one of the superstars of the late 70s. Navarrete, whose intelligence gives the sport an enlightening prospect, battled to a close victory over Mentzer's little brother, Ray. In what may be the most frightening example of hereditary pattern, the Mentzer brothers together could theoretically sire an army of brutes, at least if the present strain of genes continued. Younger brother Ray exhibited a physique similar to Mike's, although a year or two behind. Future contests may see the two competing against each other in a more heated fashion, giving the game a good dose of sibling rivalry. Muscular Joe Nazario of Long Island placed third in the tall class and perhaps may have fared better if it were not for his glaring inexperience in presentation. Bob Klez of Massachusetts finished fourth. The overall confrontation boiled down to the matter of Padilla's shape and ideal proportion versus Mentzer's astounding mass. Both of these athletes will be joining the seemingly inconquerable Robbie Robinson to form the USA team for the World Championships, the Mr. Universe, November 6th in Montreal. While the U.S. team may relinquish valuable points by sending two mediums and a short rather than a candidate in each height class, it nevertheless stands without question that the squad will still loom strongest in international competition. But in an event of such far-reaching importance, Robinson is not strolling in on a cloud of overconfidence. "I have only missed one day all year from training," said Robinson, "and you know how hard I train. Obviously, I want to win the universe more than anything in my life, but you can never be too sure in a contest of this type with so many guys. Who knows what monster will come out of nowhere from some obscure country? The Europeans are always tough, and they may have the advantage of following my training and progress because of the publicity I get through Muscle Builder. But I haven't a clue who or what sort of shape the Europeans will show up in." A special USA team pose down was staged in conjunction with the American Championships. Not that it really had to be held. There was no denying Robinson his berth, and based on their excellent showings in the America only minutes before, it was safe to assume that Padilla and Mentzer would be flying north too. Other bodybuilders who gave it a shot were Navarrete, Ray Mentzer, Carlos Rodriguez, and Skip Robinson. Darcy Beckles led a formidable contingent from Barbados and the West Indies into the Big Apple to win the Mr. Western Hemisphere contest. Standing 5'9" and flipping the Toledos at a solid 210, Beckles has won the tall class at the 1975 Mr. World. Beckles also copped the best poser and most muscular awards along with his height class. He edged out Californian Skip Robinson, medium category champion, and shortman Loftus Roach of the West Indies. Earl Cottawoo took second behind Beckles, who was a cousin to England's Albert Beckles, in the tall class. Stanley Blinder and Dave Shepard, both natives of the Caribbean, won third and fourth spots, respectively. Trinidadian transplant Franklin Green of New York placed second in the medium class. Art Stander of Barbados was awarded third ahead of Holland's Case Pending. In the short division, Bill Mitchell of New York won second. Quebec's Jocelyn Pelletier claimed third, with New York's Tommy Majong in fourth. In the Miss Americana pageant, Marilyn Person topped the field. Anne-Marie Cadet placed second, and Nitza Maldonado was third. All right, and of course this article is full of great pictures from that contest. So I wish I could show you the guys these pictures, but some great shots of Padilla and Mentzer, and a great report by Jack Neary. All right, guys, that's our show for this week. Be sure to come back next week for part two of our interview with John Little. Hope you guys are training hard out there. Stay safe, and we'll see you guys next week. Take care.